Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Tulane University's Zachary Lazar, whose new novel is I Pity the Poor Immigrant. We'll also hear from best-selling author Frances Mays, author of the much-loved Under the Tuscan Sun, who has a new, surprisingly Southern memoir out called Under Magnolia. And we'll talk with Whitney Stewart, whose new children's book is A Catfish Tale. Zachary Lazar has lived in New Orleans since 2011 and teaches creative writing at Tulane University. He's the author of the novels Sway and Aaron, Approximately, and the harrowing memoir Evening's Empire, The Story of My Father's Murder. His new book is I Pity the Poor Immigrant, which draws from both history and memoir to create a fascinating kind of fiction. Zachary, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
Now, I Pity the Poor Immigrant is many things. It's a novel about the many facets of Jewish identity, gangsters like Meyer Lansky, Jewish poets, Jewish politics, Holocaust survivors, elusive, interesting women, and the connection between Jews and Israel. What a hybrid of things to put together. So, formally, this must have been a great challenge to write.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love the description you just gave of the book. And it was a challenge to write this book. It was the hardest book I've ever done. So it's book number four, but it was really the most difficult one, with lots of long stretches of time where I couldn't get anywhere at all with it. And I guess I was just trying to pull so many different things into the story that it was hard to make the story move forward instead of just moving sideways. A novel that moves sideways is not a very entertaining novel to read. So it took me a long time to figure out how to make the story click into place and
be suspenseful. So describe the plot for us, because it's very complicated.
It's complicated, yeah. The plot all kind of centers around this woman journalist named Hannah Groff, who's from America, who gets involved investigating the murder of this Israeli writer whose name is David Belin. And Belin has written this book about the biblical King David, in which he compares biblical King David to modern-day Israeli gangsters. And this leads Hannah down this kind of rabbit hole of gangsters in Israel, gangsters in America, biblical gangsters, and a whole bunch of other things that just sort of end up having to do with Jewish people and violence on both sides of that equation, both as victims of it and as perpetrators of it. And so she's kind of a bit of a private eye, I guess, in this novel. She's a journalist investigating this story, and the story just keeps expanding outward as she goes through the book. And she learns a lot about her own past while doing this, too.
And the feeling is very noir as you're reading it.
Yeah.
You know, it really is.
Yeah.
Now, this novel follows your memoir about your father's death, which must have been so hard to write. And the character says, what we need is a memoir without a self. Mm. Was that how returning to fiction was for you after writing that memoir?
That's a really interesting question. In the book about my father, I really didn't want to be in that book very much. I was in there a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I wanted the spotlight to be on him. And part of writing that book, I'm sure, was me not only learning about my father, but learning about how all kinds of things in the past can affect us, even if we don't know what they are, if we're completely ignorant of these things. And that was part of what I was trying to write about with this new book, was how history shapes us, whether we know it or not. And so a memoir without a self, I mean, she is very much in the book, actually. So,
she is.
But I think what her discovery in this book is learning that she doesn't have as much control over who she is as she maybe thought she did before.
It's fascinating. Now, one of the things that I love most about this novel is that it goes all the way back to King David. It goes back to the very roots of violence and the politics of the nation, and even specifically to the right of return, which I find so fascinating. I wish you'd talk about that and the whole Meyer Lansky thing.
Yeah. You know, at the beginning of this book, I just knew that I wanted to write something about Meyer Lansky and also King David. It was a strange, very unlikely pairing in a way, kind of a crazy idea. So I looked at Lansky's whole biography, and the part that seemed to be most interesting to me anyway was this relationship he had with Israel, because he tried to get citizenship in Israel at the end of his life.
Sanctuary.
Yeah. And he lived there for a while, and he became to feel very attached to the place. And even after they kicked him out of Israel and denied his request for citizenship, he came back to America and he lived out his life in Miami Beach in pretty comfortable circumstances. He was never convicted of anything. But he always was still pining away for Israel, and I was really curious about that. What did it mean to him? And the deeper I looked into what that could mean to him, it was about what does it mean to be Jewish in a way, mm-hmm. you know?
And specifically, the right of return is that anyone who is Jewish can immigrate to Israel unless they have a criminal past.
Yeah, I mean, there's exceptions that are basically usually criminal ones, mm-hmm. but, you know, it is a very big part of the ethos of Israel that, mm-hmm. that this goes on. And so to have someone deny you that right, yes. so to speak, is a kind of earthly damnation in a way. You know, it can't feel good.
But then on the other hand, every time Hannah goes to Israel, mm-hmm. the customs people, the airline people, they all say, well, that's a Jewish name. Why is this your first time?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
The kind of that reverse.
She doesn't really want to be accepted there and yes. Is very dubious about the place.
And is working out all those complicated feelings.
Yeah.
So the women in this book are so extraordinary.
How much
fun were they to write?
They were a lot of fun, actually. And I had no idea that they were going to be this big a part of the book when I started the book. I had no idea. I struggled a lot at the first year of writing this book, trying this, trying that, and nothing was working. The only thing that was working was this one scene that I had was between Lansky and this mistress of his in Tel Aviv named Gila. And I thought that was working. Those were good scenes. And the more I wrote about her, the more interested I got in her. And finally, I was more interested in her than I was in him in a certain way. And so then I had a realization that I had to keep her in the book because I didn't plan on doing that either. He kind of leaves her in Tel Aviv when he's getting kicked out of Israel. And I thought her story was sort of over there, that she was, you know. But then I decided, no, let's push forward. Let's imagine another set of chapters about her. And then once I had that realization, it sort of seemed that was the key to everything, probably, was the women in relationship to these guys. They were the way to make the story come alive in a more complicated way. I think it would have been too macho otherwise, you know.
And Gila, of course, was the Holocaust survivor who represents something so important in that spectrum of people you were looking at.
Yeah.
And I especially love that epigraph at the beginning from Meyer Lansky. I'm not a kneeling Jew who comes to sing songs in your ears.
I love that epigraph, too, I have to say. He would sometimes say these oddly poetic things, which is surprising. And that was one of the things he said. And he said that in front of, like, a congressional committee looking into organized crime. So it took some guts to say that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it also is an interesting epigraph to the book because I am a Jew who comes to sing songs in your ears. You know, I'm not a kneeling Jew, but what follows then is this kind of song, you know, a story.
And then you name the book for a song.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think of it when I was doing it, or consciously anyway, but this sort of contrast between artists and gangsters is very much a part of the book, and I don't know if I could really say much about what that contrast consists of, but it's there.
Well, one of the things that I adore about this book is that it takes advantage of so many forms. You know, there are stories within stories, purported news stories. Real people, like there are the names of real painters in this book, for example, and photographs.
Yes.
The inclusion of photographs in fiction, which is always a very tricky business, isn't it? Did that make it harder or more fun?
I love the photographs, so definitely on the side of more fun. In fact, I often am discouraged from putting them in, but some people are fans of them. And I think, I mean, when you're talking about King David from the Bible, and then you have a picture of this field where he supposedly killed Goliath, and, you know, in that field is a bag of Lay's potato chips, there's something about that that's just kind of magical to me. I don't know why.
I know. I kind of love it because you're reading along. It's like, yes, this is a true story.
I mean,
a true story.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I love that playing around with what's real and what's not, what's made up, what's not. Yeah.
We've been talking with Zachary Lazar, whose compelling new novel is I Pity the Poor Immigrant. You can meet him Thursday, April 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Zach, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks a lot.
I pity the poor immigrant who wishes he would have stayed home, who uses all his power to do evil and
as I imagine most interviewers do, I am approaching Frances Mays with stone-cold jealousy. She lives the life, one she's chronicled in such compelling and enviable memoirs as Under the Tuscan Sun, Every Day in Tuscany, even the Tuscan Sun Cookbook, as well as A Year in the World and the novel Swan. She's back with a poetic and fascinating coming-of-age chronicle, Under Magnolia, a Southern memoir, and like many a Southern story worth its salt, it involves some good times in our own New Orleans. Frances Mays, so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And so jealous. I mean it. Could you have possibly imagined the course your life would take?
No, I think that's one of the great joys of life is that you can't imagine. But I always have to think, you know, you make your luck. So in a way you can imagine it in some kind of fantasy world.
Well, this book is something very lovely and very different for you. It's a story of growing up in the South. What was it like for you to go back to those family stories?
I think writing a memoir is a very strange undertaking because you have absolutely no idea from the outset the kind of depths you're going to get to in memory and how, as you write memories, other memories just seem to rise to the surface from those memories. So there's a big unexpected chain effect. It was very surprising compared to writing my books on Tuscany, where I knew the story I was going to tell. And of course, to some extent I did with this, but just how much it brought up from the past and how redolent the past is with sensory images was the surprising event of my writing life, I think.
Poet Kathleen Fraser says, one hears one's childhood and it is ancient. I've always loved that.
Yes, it is. At the same time, it's very immediate. It's kind of a strange back and forth between the past and present that you fall in and out of in writing.
Right, the freshness of the moment and the recollection and the craft it takes to put it together.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that's always drawn me into your writing is the sensual detail, your attention to taste and textures. In Under Magnolia, the way you describe a dress, for example, or even a bunch of biscuits. And in this new book, we see how much of that has come out of that observant childhood of yours.
I guess it starts there. The South is such a powerful landscape that I think very early on, I was aware of what power it had on a sensory level. Just simple things like the rain starting to fall from far away and you see it walking across the field toward you, or the big blistering sunset. It's a lot of impact that comes to you just through the landscape. So I think that the sensory impact of the landscape was what first impressed me. And then I was a reader as a child, and I learned early on to love language that was able to recreate something in words. So as a writer, that always attracted me, that level of detail and how you can reach a reader through two sensory details put together so that the body cannot resist that. The body is so involved in sensory life. So creating images, I've always felt like was the most vivid way to write an experience. And that's what I've always really been interested in as a writer.
And now another thing about Under Magnolia that was such a pleasure just for me, and I'm sure will be for every other book lover, is that description of your childhood reading and the books that you remember.
I kept a reading log as a child. I try to get my grandson to do that. But he says, oh, Franny, I have it all on Kindle anyway.
Oh,
so
no.
I think the days of the reading log might be over. But I still like looking back at what I was reading when I was young. It's fun. I didn't have much discrimination, but I was pretty omnivorous. So I ended up reading a lot of books.
Now, and of course, you have some good times in New Orleans in this book. I wish you'd tell us about those.
My college roommate, she's still my friend and she lives here near me in Chapel Hill, invited me a lot to New Orleans in the summer. We kind of made journeys around the South going to each other's houses. And, of course, everybody wanted to go to New Orleans. And while I was there, I fell very much in love with her brother. So I had the good luck to be young and madly in love in New Orleans and to walk along the levees late at night and go to all the rainy courtyard bars and dances at the country club, and it was just such a romantic city to me. So
nothing
I'm looking forward to coming back after all these years.
Well, there's nothing like it still.
I know. I'm already lining up my restaurant.
Oh, good, good. And not only that, not only the memoir of your childhood, this is a story about returning to live in the South for part of the year.
Yes, I had my entire grown-up career as a university professor in San Francisco, but I had this kind of moment of epiphany when I was on book tour in Oxford, and I was just inundated by, again, as we talked about earlier, all the beautiful sensory details of fragrances and the canopy of leaves, and I had this kind of instant desire to move back to the South. And that is what happened after a couple of years. So this book is kind of bookended. First chapter and last chapter are about moving back and what it's like to move back here after many, many years in California. And then the middle of the book is scenes from South Georgia childhood a long time ago.
And in North Carolina, you have wonderful literary friends. I like to imagine you telling stories with Alan Gurganis and Lee Smith. I bet you all have a lot of fun.
We do. It's a great place to live. I feel like I landed in such a lucky place.
And you have this wonderful thing that you've written that I just adore. The South always has enjoyed its eccentric people. I'm glad because I intend to become more and more that way myself. I'm done with my life quest to appear normal. So do you feel freer now that you're back in the South in some ways?
I do. Somehow I do. I guess it's just where you learn to walk. As Blake says, if you learn to walk on frozen toes, you're different. But I learned to walk in the South, so at just some kind of metabolic level, I feel more myself here, although I loved living in California, and I'm so glad I did at that time. But we also live part of the year in Italy, so in these two places, I think I feel the most at home of anywhere I've ever lived.
Well, it's a lovely, lovely book. We've been talking with the delightful Frances Mays, whose new book is Under Magnolia, a Southern Memoir. You can meet her Friday, April 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much, Frances.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Whitney Stewart is an all-around children's book person. She's written biographies of Sir Edmund Hillary, the Dalai Lama, Aung San Suu Kyi, Walt Disney, and a guide to New Orleans called Jammin' on the Avenue, among many other books. Her new book is a picture book, The Catfish Tale. Hi, Whitney.
Hi, Susan.
Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So what made you turn to the picture book form? I know you've done this before, but you go back and forth.
I do go back and forth. But after researching these heady books, and you spend a year researching or more very serious topics about Nobel Peace Prize winners or lately the World War II, you got to do something fun and light and freeing for your soul.
And this is that.
Yeah.
This is a really fun book. So how was this process different for you?
Oh, it was so much fun, and it was very collaborative. I started off telling this story. It's a Grimm's tale, The Fisherman and His Wife. I used to live in Germany, so I said it in Germany, but that was too boring. And I was reading it to my reading group at Kindling Words. It's a wonderful group of writers and illustrators. And they said, why don't you set it in Louisiana? I mean, you live there. And I was like, duh. So I did. And that changed the language, the rhythm, the pace, the characterization, everything. And then I worked with a wonderful friend of mine, Doug Cushman, in Paris. And he'd been here before, and he loves steel string guitar. And we'd go back and forth. And he lived in Paris, and I would send my manuscript to him, and he'd, you know, say, nah, not quite. And then we'd go back and forth. And that was really fun. So it finally got down to Jacques and Jolie in the Bayou. So,
and why did you pick this particular fairy tale?
Because when I was 12 years old, I was an actor and I was the wife in A Fisherman and His Wife. And it was so much fun to play mean and to play greedy. because I don't think that's how I am in person in real life.
So.
But it was really fun to play that, and it stuck in my psyche. And I even contacted the playwright who wrote the children's version, musical version of this, and said, can you send me the script? Because I want to look at the lines that I used to use back then. And she did.
Ah.
So it really was collaborative. And in the back of my mind, always, I had Colleen Sally, who also retold tales and set them in Louisiana. And Colleen was my friend, and she was a fabulous storyteller and, you know, queen bee of kid lit in New Orleans, as we all know.
And beyond.
And beyond. And she just was in my heart while I was writing this. And I could hear her voice in the voices of A Catfish Tale. And I wish she were here to read it now, because I think she would do a much better job than I do, because I'm a Yankee.
So. Oh, you can be an honorary Cajun for purposes of this book. But it's true. Colleen really taught, I think, a lot of us how to make stories new.
Mm-hmm.
In telling and in reading, don't you
did.
Think?
She did. And I wish she were here to read it. That's just why I dedicated it to her.
Well, it's a lovely, lovely tribute to her. So did you read it to any children? Did you try it out on young readers?
I tried it out on my son, who's not young. In fact, he was probably upper teens. But he's a musician, and he has a very good sense of rhythm and character and theatrics. So I tried it first on him, and then I tried it on a couple of kids when I finally got to the Jacques and Jolie in the Bayou version.
Well, you know, everybody says that the perfect children's picture book is really a poem.
Mm.
You know, it has to have that elegance of language and economy and just that certain rhythm for reading out loud.
On that note, I wanted to say that I put it in rhyme for a while just to see. Oh, that was a disaster. Number one, I don't do rhyme. And number two, my meter was all off. And friends of mine, fortunately, said, no, not quite.
Saved you from yourself.
Oh, Jean Castles was really good there.
Oh, yes. And then where did you find your illustrator? This is one of those evocative books that really needed a Louisiana flavor.
It did. And that was wonderful. Of course, you know, as a writer, I didn't get to choose. Albert Whitman chose the illustrator, and they knew Gérald. Gérald Gellier did a fabulous job, and he lives in Paris. So we're back to Paris again. But he understood sort of the flavor of the Cajun French that I was throwing in there. And I sent my editor a lot of photographs of New Orleans. I went around and took pictures of paddle wheel boat and French Quarter. And I had a great picture of a catfish. And
I have to say, I do love the drawing of the catfish.
I do, too. And it was a process. You know, I saw some early drawings, and then I saw, and bingo, he got it. But, you know, by those late drawings. And we've become friends over Facebook and email, Gérald, and I can't wait to meet him in Paris. We've never met.
So what is it like when you have written a story, and you're bound to acquire some mental images along the way? What is it like for you to first see what someone else makes of your words?
Well, one thing is I tried not to have images of the characters, not too strong, because I didn't want to be disappointed when I actually saw the illustrations. But I was surprised by Jolie's bold, I'm not very good at describing how she looks now, but she just comes out there, and that's her personality. But in the play that I was in, the wife was fat. I had to wear a big pillow underneath my clothes. And Jolie here is very, you know, she's elegant and beautiful. She comes from the bayou, but she really wants to be a star. So she looks quite the star. And that was surprising to me. Jacques is maybe younger, perhaps, than I saw him in my mind. But again, I tried not to stick too closely to that image in my head. So I was happily surprised, particularly with the alligator and the catfish, because they just pop up all over the place, and that's fun.
And so many people don't realize that in children's books, you really often don't know your illustrator.
It's very interesting. But in this case, it's been a really fun process.
So has this led you to think you'll do more books like this now?
I will, and I'd really like to do another one with Gérald, and Albert Whitman is actually publishing another picture book of mine next year, Big Sky Mind. It's a mindfulness book for kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm going to do another retelling, a Grimm retelling.
Oh, good. And we should say that, you know, Buddhism and meditation have been long-time interests of yours.
Yes, they have. I hope kids will enjoy Big Sky Mind. mind as well. It's illustrated by my friend Sally Rippon, who's an Australian illustrator.
Oh, Whitney Stewart goes global. I like it. We've been talking with Whitney Stewart, whose new gorgeous picture book is The Catfish Tale. You can meet her Saturday, April 12th at 1:30 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Whitney.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Mona Lisa Saloy signs Second Line Home, New Orleans Poems, Tuesday, April 8th at 5:30 at the Will Alexander Library at Dillard University. Octavia Books hosts a triple header Wednesday, April 9th. First, Grammy Award winner, musician, actor, and New York Times bestselling author Rick Springfield appears at 3 o'clock in anticipation of his forthcoming novel, Magnificent Vibration. Springfield will sign original lithographs and book plates he created for the book, which will be released on May 6th. To meet Rick, you must purchase a ticket. Then, George Packard discusses and signs The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, at 5:30. Then, Dane Hucklebridge discusses and signs Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit. That's at 7 p.m. All those events at Octavia Books, Wednesday, April 9th. Author Daniel Black discusses and signs his book, Perfect Peace, Wednesday, April 9th at 6 at the Main Library, 219 Loyola Avenue. Poet Jeff Munsterman reads at Poetry Night, Thursday, April 10th at 6 p.m. at the Bell Chase Library. Today's guest, Zachary Lazar, signs I Pity the Poor Immigrant, Thursday, April 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Sarah Barrett discusses and signs Kentucky Sweets, Bourbon Balls, Spoon Bread, and Mile High Pie, Thursday, April 10th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. That's part of the Culinary Legacy Series that's hosted by Liz Williams, founder and president of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Today's guest, Frances Mays, signs Under Magnolia, a Southern Memoir, Friday, April 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Candace Huber presents a workshop on social media at the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meeting, Friday, April 11th at 6 at the New Orleans Museum of Art Library. New members are always welcome. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Who Fears Death by Nnedi Okorafor, Saturday, April 12th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Whitney Stewart, reads from and signs A Catfish Tale, Saturday, April 12th at 1:30 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will conduct its semi-annual Big Book Sale. That's Thursday, April 10th to Sunday, April 13th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are 10 to 8 Thursday through Saturday, April 10th through 12th, and noon to 5 on Sunday, April 13th. Poet Nina Oedrago reads from her work, followed by an open mic, Sunday, April 13th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Perhaps you've noticed those little free libraries popping up all over town. Want one of your own? Here's your chance. A French Quarter-themed Little Free Library has been donated to New Orleans by littlefreelibrary.org. Anyone who wants it should write a one-page letter, 500 words maximum, explaining why I want a little free library and what it would do for my neighborhood. Please include your name, address, phone number, and email address at the top. By May 31st, email the letter to nolalibrary@yahoo.com, and a panel of judges will select the winner. The library must be located in New Orleans, and installation on private property is recommended. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.